The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Maker had a 45-year career at the University of Connecticut in the music department until his retirement in 2009. He directed bands, taught, and served as associate head of the music department. Now, full disclosure, I was one of the fortunate students in his orchestration class when I attended UConn. He holds degrees and diplomas from UConn, Michigan State University, and the University of Calgary, and did doctoral studies at the College Conservatory of Music at the University of Cincinnati. The talented musician began playing carillon in 1994, and I am delighted that David Maker is joining me via Zoom to talk about carillons and what he finds so captivating about them. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
So let's just start with the basics. First things first, what is a carillon?
A carillon, there is a sort of an official, semi-official definition, and that is at least 23 bells tuned so well that they can be played in harmony with each other, and that they are played from a keyboard that allows expression through sensitivity of touch. That covers a lot of ground. Notice that it doesn't necessarily have to be up in a tower, although there usually are bells up in a tower. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of things it excludes as well. When one hears bells in a tower or thinks one hears bells in a tower, well, maybe it's a carillon and maybe it's not. Maybe it's just a recording. Maybe it's a mechanism playing on real bells, but not a person playing on a keyboard. Maybe it's a recording of real bells. Maybe it's a recording of just some synthesized sound. And it's always fun for me when I hear bell-like sounds coming out of a tower, trying to figure out whether they're real. Oh. The idea of a real definition of a carillon is, you know, something, a fussy matter in some ways. Mm-hmm. But we people who play the carillon, we're kind of protective about that.
Yeah. So is there some way for a layman to know the difference when you hear this? Or does one have to have the kind of expertise that you do to know the difference between whether it's one of those options you just explained?
Well, not an absolutely sure thing, but likely clues. If you hear that the actual percussive sound at the beginning is very strong and distinct from the resonance that comes afterwards, mm-hmm. that probably is real bells. Hmm. And if you can hear varied dynamics and perhaps rubato or some kinds of changes in the rhythm, then that is another clue that it probably is real bells. It could still be a recording of someone else who has played real bells, because many towers now have big loudspeakers in them, as well as the bells themselves. Mm-hmm. So they can play an imitation of themselves, or they can play other kinds of music as accompaniment to bell playing, etc. Most don't, but several do have such speakers in their towers.
So I can't believe I have to ask you this question. Is piano your primary instrument? Was that your original introduction to music?
Shall we say it's not my major. I took piano lessons from way back, like first grade. Okay. I liked to play, but hated to practice. And my major instrument in undergraduate was percussion. But I've been near carillons. I had been near carillons a lot before I began to play. Mm-hmm. And it is, some piano skill is usually considered really necessary as a forerunner to playing on the carillon, because it's so hard to practice, because you have to go to wherever the instrument is. Mm-hmm. And also it's a different kind of feel on the keyboard. And to have to learn the basics of music theory in the first place on a carillon is much more difficult than learning the basics on a keyboard instrument and then moving over to carillon.
Okay. Well, those of us who know you as a musician and as a teacher know that you are someone who has a wide variety of interests and that you don't do anything halfway. But I want you to explain, how did this all start back in 1994? What exactly piqued your interest in carillons to the point that you wanted to become the expert that you've become in it?
Well, the immediate opportunity to learn and start playing came in something you know perfectly well about, and that is Storrs Congregational Church on the corner of Route 195. There's a carillon in there. It's unique. The university owns it, but it's housed in a church. And there's no other situation like that in all of North America. Somebody wrote into the university and said, this carillon is in trouble. It's been hurting, and nobody's been touched it for years. Can't you do something about it? That went from the president's office down to the dean's office, and that went to the department head's office, and that went to me. Hey, Maker, you like the bells. Could you see about this? Make a report. So I went and looked at it, and I asked some people, and I did make a report, but at the same time, I was intrigued myself. And so I started to learn to play them. And I studied with a lovely man in Hartford at Trinity College, where they give group lessons for free. And also with a well-known caroliner in Massachusetts. And no, I got fairly good. There is a status caroliner member in the Guild of Caroliners in North America, and you attain that status by exam. I took the exam, I think, in 1999 and passed it. So now I am the creme de la creme. Ha, ha, ha.
Now, you also went to study at the Netherlands Carillon School, and you know the
just very briefly. I have no diploma or anything like that, but on part of a sabbatical semester, I spent time over there learning how it's taught over there and how it's done. I picked up a lot.
Now, I know you'll correct me if this is not the right information, but I believe that carillons were invented in the Netherlands in about the 15th century. Is that right?
That's approximately right. In the Low Countries, Belgium has a little bit more of a credit than the Netherlands, although I'm a Netherlands person myself. There were originally, I mean, I could go through a whole long history talk here, but there have been bells and towers, at least for alarm purposes, signaling that the Norsemen were coming or that there was a fire, etc. And as the countries grew in prosperity, they started adding more bells, especially after 1300. 1300, approximately then, is a real landmark time because that is the invention of the clock. Dividing the day up into 24 equal parts, no matter whether it's summer or winter, it's all the same to the clock. And so they would have chiming mechanisms that would go ding dong on the hour to let you know that an hour had passed. And then that became more elaborate. For instance, we all know bong, 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 a four bell signal of the hour. And usually afterwards, bong, 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 whatever o'clock it happens to be. So one of the things that happened in the development is that, say, you were in the evening and all of a sudden your ear picks up bong, bong, but you don't know whether that was 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock or whether it was 7 o'clock and 8 o'clock. That's what the bong, 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 bong is for, to tell you when the hour strokes begin. So then you'll know you heard it right. That's what time it is.
Ah, interesting. So like kind of like attention, attention.
Right. The first keyboard came around 1510. And then in the 1600s, in the great prosperity of the Netherlands, the tulip craze, for instance, the number of bells in a tower expanded Everybody wanted to show off how many bells they had and how fancy an instrument they had. Mm-hmm. And if you see pictures sometimes of bells in Holland or in Belgium with bells actually sticking out the tower, out the sides a little bit, that's probably because the tower was built first and then they put in too many bells for the tower and they had to stick them out the side. They couldn't contain them all inside the tower that they had built.
Wow.
Actually, I can tell you now, continue a little history bit.
Sure.
That continued through the 1600s, the 1700s, most of the 1800s. But all through that time, it wasn't taken really, really seriously as a musical instrument. There had been people who learned to play it. Some sheet music got published. There were some transcriptions of other songs that people could play, but it was mostly a market day instrument. It was an ambient background sound contributing to the quality of life. Mm-hmm. It wasn't thought of as a concert instrument until late 1800s. I think 1888 was the first big public concert by a man in Belgium named Jef de Nijne. And he had Monday evening concerts. And he was a virtuoso, and he invented some mechanisms that improved the instrument so that it could be played more expressively, and had a commanding personality, and people flocked to hear him. So at that point, the carillon became a concert instrument in addition to still being an ambient instrument. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then the funny thing happens, the weird thing, in my opinion, happens after the First World War, where people coming back from having fought in the war and also some wealthy Americans traveling abroad latched onto the carillon and said, we got to get some over here. Mm-hmm. And so they did. The first modern carillon in the U.S. is 1922, and that's in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Hmm. The one in stores, by the way, is 1931, so it's not that much later. But there was a problem, and that was that the people who brought these over didn't conceive of them as anything but a concert instrument. And so they brought it over, they brought carillons and had them installed with the thought that they were going to be concert instruments and people were going to flock to hear them when there was no such tradition in this country. Mm. So it's been kind of a struggle. There are some places that have carillon concert series that are wildly successful, but other places that have carillon concert series that are wildly unsuccessful. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've been around, I've played them both kinds and everything in between. Mm-hmm.
And in fact, these instruments are all over the world, and I understand that there are hundreds of them throughout the United States.
I guess it would be important to understand how prominent they are, given that there are so many other things that sound like carillons. Mm-hmm. There are about 600 of them in the world. Mm-hmm. About 180 of them are in the U.S.
Okay.
So that gives you an idea of perhaps how widely they are distributed in this country. There are many states that have no carillons at all in them. Connecticut, where you and I are from, has 11 carillons, which is probably the highest concentration per square mile, shall we say, of anywhere in the country. Hmm. There are a lot in Texas. There are a lot in California. Uh-huh. There are 6 or 7 or 8 in New York, ditto for Massachusetts, and so on.
Uh-huh. And you've held carillon positions at several of those Connecticut churches, and I know that you've given recitals in 50 different venues in 10 states, as well as Canada, Netherlands, and Portugal. So do you have any favorite instruments of all those that you've had the opportunity to play?
Maybe. I don't want to pick a favorite that excludes somebody else because there's a lot of good ones, but one that stands out in my mind is Longwood Gardens in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania, mushroom capital of the known universe. Longwood Gardens is a state of one of the DuPont families. Mm-hmm. And it is a very large estate with gorgeous, gorgeous gardens and fountains and a carillon that was installed fairly recently that can be played either manually, or it can be played with pneumatic hammers that hammer the bells, either from a computer-generated recording, or they even have a little regular electronic keyboard, I noticed, hanging up, lined up against the wall in the playing cabin. People hear that as ambient music as they're walking through the gardens. And they also have scheduled concerts with chairs drawn up. And so some people don't just settle for the ambient, but they sit down and hear the instrument, hear it being played. And there is, as there are at many places, a closed circuit TV screen so that they can watch the player if they wish.
What's different about playing a carillon than from other instruments? What are, you know, what is the, I assume it's different than just, you know, sitting down at a keyboard and playing as one might do with a piano. So what are some of the different skills required?
Well, the first thing is that you don't have ivory keyboard with flat keys. So you couldn't do a Chico Marx glissando on a carillon because you don't have that kind of keys. You have wooden dowels that are sticking out, and they're separated. There's a little space between each one. And there are two rows of them, black keys and white keys, though they're usually not painted to differentiate the colors. So it's on a much larger scale, just as dimensions. The kind of standard size is 4 octaves, which would be about as wide as a piano keyboard, or maybe even a little bit wider. Piano keyboard is like 7 octaves. Carillon keyboard is 4 octaves, though some are smaller, some are larger. That's the standard size, though. One of the funny things about carillon playing is that if you're sitting right in front of the keys, then you can play them. You can see exactly where a G is, where an F sharp is, where an A flat is. But if you're sitting in the middle and you have to look up toward the upper end, there's a big height differential between the black keys and the white keys. So you can't tell at first that A is sitting between A flat and B flat, because the A flat and B flat are up at a whole different level. So you have to get used to that. Wow. After a while, though, you do. Another thing about carillon is that there is a pedal board. It just duplicates usually the lower half of the manual keyboard. And each of these are usually played mechanically. And so you hit them. The preferred method is with a lightly closed fist, with the back fingers, the pinky fingers of a lightly closed fist. But you can turn the hand over and play them underhand, as it were, just straight down on the keys with your fingertips. And you can also play with your palm down to achieve double stops. You can play a third easily if they're both on the same color of key. And if you have a good reach, you can play a fourth, two notes simultaneously. But you can't play huge, widely spaced chords because their hand span isn't going to be enough. Usually the most you could do would be maybe a 6-note chord, 2 notes with your right hand, 2 notes double stop with your left hand, and both feet, bonk, bonk, on 2 different notes. But you probably wouldn't want to do that even if you could, because another problem with the carillon is that the bells resonate.
Yeah.
Just the opposite of, say, an organ. An organ, the sound comes as long as you have your finger down on the key. And when you take your finger off, it stops. But a carillon, you hit it once, it goes ding. And you can't control how long that resonates. So carillons typically have simplicity in the rhythm of the music that they play. It may be tricky rhythms, but it won't be necessarily dense rhythms of chords being played all at once. If you'll forgive me, Suzanne, I'm sitting right next to an electronic keyboard.
Okay.
So if I wanted to play this chord, which is 4 notes, I could do that, but it will sound a whole lot better on the bells if I go as an arpeggio.
Okay.
And playing. And another funny one is that on a piano, you play scales like that, and you can do that on a carillon as well. But if you do this, it sounds 10 times more virtuosic, and yet it's actually easier than playing a straight scale. Left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right.
So that's
in a nutshell, the technique of playing carillon. Mm-hmm. I did want at some point to cite for your listeners one YouTube that is very good at illustrating what carillon playing can be.
Okay.
And if you don't mind, I'd like to just tell you the key words for that.
Sure.
Somebody can go on YouTube and they can look up Vesterkirk Carillon Bach Toccata D minor. And that's Vesterkirk is Westerkerk. Carillon, just so you know how it's correctly spelled, is Carillon. Mm-hmm. So Vesterkirk Carillon Bach Toccata D minor.
Okay.
And when you put in those words, you will come to one of the finest carillon players in the world. His name is Boudewijn Zwart. Vesterkirk is one block down from Anne Frank's house. This is the bells that she heard when they were hiding out in the back. Mm. And he plays the familiar da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da.
Uh-huh.
And shows that you can do wonderful things with that, even though this is not an organ and you can't control the release of the notes.
Right.
Just a beautiful sound and thrilling to watch him play as well as hear.
Well, we'll definitely put a link to that that YouTube. I'll make sure that that's on available when we post this conversation. You raise a really good point about some of the considerations for playing carillon, and of course that then translates into the unique considerations for writing carillon music. Now, you're a very experienced composer and arranger of a variety of works. So what are some of those special considerations? Are there additional things one must do when writing carillon music or consider?
Well, the first thing to know about writing carillon music is that it looks like piano music because it's on two staves, mm-hmm. a treble clef staff and a bass clef staff, but they have different functions. The bass clef staff is for your feet, and the treble clef staff is for both hands. If both hands are playing in different rhythms, then the higher line is stems up and the lower line is stems down, but they're both on the treble clef staff. If they're playing together rhythmically to make chords or intervals, then they can be just the usual stems up and stems down that you would have in any kind of piano notation. It looks like piano notation, but and sometimes it will show like maybe a half note and then a rest after that. But you can't really control that because of the resonance of the bells. Mm-hmm. So the notation is sometimes simplified a little bit, not in when the attacks are, but not making it all look like 16th notes or something of that sort. It looks pretty similar at first glance to piano music. Mm-hmm. You do notice that the feet part, the bottom staff, is way simpler than the top staff, the hand part, because of course your feet are more awkward for one thing. And the other thing is those are the big bells. Those are the slowest speaking bells. Mm. Those are the ones that take the most effort to play. So it stands to reason that the bass part is going to be simpler than the upper parts.
Sure. Sure.
That means that you have to be really careful, by the way, when you're transcribing something from the Baroque era or from the classical era, because that won't do. That's called Alberti bass, where the bass is busier than the melody.
Right.
On a carillon, if the bass is busier than the melody, it's going to drown out the melody because it's the bigger bells.
Uh-huh.
So there is a lot of carillon writing, both transcriptions and original compositions, where it's done just the other way around. Like that.
Okay.
Where the arpeggiation comes in the right hand, even though it's accompaniment, the melody in the feet, even though it was originally the melody, the soprano melody. If I could add, if you're going to take advantage of the instrument's strengths, then you're going to write in some rhythmic things, because it is very good with rhythm. It's very good with rhythmic nuances. Tempo rubato, grace notes work just fine, very good with dynamics. The dynamic range on a carillon is maybe greater than the dynamic range on a piano. You can play a note very loudly or very softly. You can phrase. You can make things come out so they sound like a phrase, even though you can't do all the controlling of the release of notes. Nevertheless, with little nuances of starting up and stopping down at the end of a phrase and starting up at the beginning of the next phrase, you can shape phrases. And you see an awful lot of legato marks in carillon music, even though you can't play a true legato. But you can feel it, and you can make the feeling happen to the listener.
Because, you know, many musical instruments have different styles, not only of the way they're made, but also in the way they are played or the kind of music that is written for them. Is that the same for carillons? Do different countries have different types of instruments and different styles of playing or different styles of music that would typically be played on them?
There are two that come to mind, and that is the Netherlands versus Belgium. Belgium, which is more nearly the place of the origin of the modern carillon, has a lot of tremolos, the equivalent of a tremolo on a stringed instrument or a roll on a drum. Can be done on just one note with some difficulty, but easily done, alternating your hand on two notes like that. There is more tremolo written into Belgian carillon music, music that comes from Belgian writers, than there is in Netherlands. The Belgian also do more romantic music because of those tremolos. They do, less contemporary confrontational music. There's more contemporary styles of music being written in the Netherlands and performed in the Netherlands. But there also are carilloners in the Netherlands whose entire stock and trade is transcriptions from earlier eras, the Baroque, the Classical, the Romantic eras.
Who were some of the more prominent early composers of carillon music?
The short answer is there aren't hardly any. There aren't hardly any. They are unprominent carillon composers because there wasn't really much dedicated carillon music that was written specifically for carillon in early years. They just took simple tunes and played them on the carillon. One of the first big names, though, is Matthias Vandengain, who was flourishing around 1760. So it's just after the Baroque era is beginning to transition into the Classical era. And his preludes, there's 11 or 12 of them, I believe, are largely arpeggios, just big, great series of arpeggios. And they're fun to play, they're very challenging, and they are often taken as the basic that a carillon student is supposed to learn, is expected to learn, Vandengain preludes. And then you don't have many composers that jump out until after 1900, when these serious concerts begin, and it's beginning to be seen as a concert instrument. And then they start to proliferate. There aren't many composers, aren't many that are the absolute highest tier composers in the musical world that you and I would know the names of that have written for Carillon. One that I can think of, and it's a little specialized, is George Crumb.
Ah.
Who wrote a piece called Easter Dawning. It is a very, very difficult piece to play. There are some very good, very good composers alive or recently alive, mm-hmm. such as John Pozdro, Ronald Barnes, Gary White. Mm-hmm. And there are publishers. There's the Guild of Caroliners in North America that publishes. You can find them online. You can buy a piece of their music. Mm-hmm. and the ACME, the American Carillon Music Editions, they also have a website, and you can see on their websites the entire catalog, sometimes hear little excerpts of the pieces. And Carillon is all over YouTube. Mm-hmm. There are, you can just type in the word Carillon and you'll get all sorts of things, all sorts of people playing all sorts of music with all degrees of expertise, music of all kinds and degrees of difficulty. The website that I mentioned to you before with the Bach D minor toccata, when someone looks that up, notice the number of views. It is pushing 800,000.
Wow.
It's, I think, by far the largest viewing that any Carillon video has had. But it was the right time, the right place, the right person, the right music. It's very well edited, and the performer is just amazing.
Hmm. All right. Will do.
One of the things about Carillon, and here I'm going to launch into a little bit of a harangue, is that they rarely play from memory. They rarely play from memory because they don't have to, because nobody can see whether they are or not.
Okay.
But if you watch this Bach toccata video, you'll see he has a piece of music in front of him, but he's not looking at it. He's got it memorized. It doesn't even have to be there at all. So he's one of the exceptions, at least for a big part of the time. Also, if you watch a lot of videos, you'll see, well, the players aren't dressed particularly in their go-to-meeting clothes because they aren't really coming through a culture where they're expected to be seen doing what they do. And the cabin playings, the cabin rooms where they play on the keyboards, sometimes they look nice, but lots of times they look very ugly and are not really a background that you would be proud to show off. Hmm. You know, all these things come from the old culture where you were just in a situation that you can't be seen.
Right.
But now with YouTube, you can be seen, right. And it's happening more and more. There are also a growing number of mobile Carillons mounted on truck beds that can go all over the country. There's maybe a half a dozen of them in the U.S. maybe, and maybe that many in Europe, or pushing that many anyway.
Really? Who is doing this? I mean, that's a pretty, I've never seen one, number one. And number two,
there's only one person, okay. At least he claims he's the only person, who has made his living out of doing that.
Okay.
His name is Frank Della Penna. He's okay. In Pennsylvania. Okay. He's just retired from doing it now. Okay. But he had a long career playing Renaissance fairs.
Oh.
And he would take his Carillon around. He transported it himself on a trailer. and he would wear a costume so that he couldn't be seen. He had a fanciful costume and called himself the Spirit of the Bells. You couldn't see his face. He was masked completely, and he played with exaggerated gestures. And he was a big success at what he did. Hmm. My thesis is that with YouTube's and other opportunities proliferating to see a performance as well as hear it, that kind of fanciful costuming and exaggeration is no longer necessary. Mm-hmm. What I found in playing the Carillon is it is a very kinetic instrument. I think it is more fun to watch somebody play that than it is to play the piano.
Hmm.
probably that's a statement that some people would argue with, but it's fun to play. It's active to play. I can think of one player in England who is so enthusiastic that he is the James Brown of the carillon in terms of sweat generated. And you can see it on his shirt when he's done, even in videos sometimes. Huh. But it is a very active, very kinetic instrument. Huh. One of the things that's unusual about playing it, going back to comparing against a piano keyboard, is that you definitely have to play close to the keys.
Okay.
So that if you want to have exaggerated motions, the expressive exaggerated motions, here's a big chord, is going to come in the release. You're going to release your hands with a flourish.
Ah, okay.
But you're going to have your hands, actually, if you really watch the player, their hands are going to be really close to the keyboard when they strike. So their aim will be good. So their control of how hard they hit the keys will be good. And they'll save all their exaggeration for the release. Uh-huh. It's kind of easy to pick up, yeah. And I mean, and to do, uh-huh. But it's one of the fun things in playing a carillon.
Hmm. Well, wow! Thank you so much for sharing your expertise and your enthusiasm for carillons.
I wish I could tell you that there was a great, great moment in the Baroque era that where carillons relate directly to the Baroque era. They were just sort of gradually getting better, mm-hmm. as time progressed through that era, with one exception. And I have to mention this, and that is around 1840. In the 1840s, there were two brothers, the Hemony brothers, H-E-M-O-N-Y, and another acoustician named Van Eck, and they perfected the art of tuning the bells to a much greater degree, to a much better degree than they ever had been before. And almost all the classic carillons in the Netherlands, in Belgium, are Hemony carillons that are still there, still working, usually with the original mechanisms, and certainly with the original bells. Mm-hmm. They are the gold standard, Hemony carillons.
Hmm.
All the carillons in the United States, almost all of them are imported from, the bells are imported from Europe, though they are new bells, not Hemony bells.
Hmm.
The one that you and I know in Storrs, Connecticut, actually is the only carillon, I think, in the world that is completely American made.
Hmm.
It's made by an American foundry. But anyway, there is that landmark in the Baroque era. It's not a landmark of repertoire, but it's a landmark in development of the instrument.
Of the instrument, yeah. Okay. Well, again, thank you for making
sure.
time to chat and for sharing all this enthusiasm and deep knowledge and expertise.
It's a great pleasure. So if somebody wants to know about more about carillons, they can write to me through you, or just get and watch a lot of videos, because you will learn a great deal about carillons.
Oh.
There is another website called Tower Bells.
Okay.
We'll run together, www.towerbells.org, that is a directory of all the multiple bell installations in the world.
Oh, wow.
And it is fantastically thorough, and one can learn a lot about carillons just from checking out that website, too.
Okay, well, we'll put a link to that as well. I have been speaking with David Maker, who is retired from the University of Connecticut Music Department and is an expert in carillons. Thank you very, very much.
It was my pleasure. It was great to be talking with you again.